And as many of you know who come here regularly, in order to make these talks relevant to the people coming here to listen to them, I do take suggestions. And two suggestions were in my tray this evening for a talk this evening, and I'm going to combine them because they actually, surprisingly, do come together. One Buddhist person was concerned about the earthquakes in Christchurch as well as other disasters in our world. And asking the old question, which I will answer again and just develop further, has this got anything to do with karma? Why does this happen? How should a Buddhist, or I'd actually say, how should a compassionate, wise person to look at such things as disasters? And the other question seems to be totally unrelated, but actually they are related, is that he says, I've been a Buddhist, and how do I use this quality of intention, just the motives, the reason why I do things? How can I use that in my daily life, at work, in the office, at home, whatever I'm doing? How can I use that to enhance my life, make it a better life? So intention and tragedies, how can these things go together? And the first thing to mention is that the people who suffer in such natural disasters as the earthquake, this is not some punishment from karma. I know that really made me very upset when sometimes people say that's God punishing people because they're bad, because they're homosexual, because they're evil, because they don't go to church, because they don't do what I think they should do. Now that really is very sick, because no spiritual leader would ever sort of punish and be cruel to such people. They wouldn't be so judgmental. And if there is any idea of a God, that's even higher than a spiritual leader. Surely that we expect some compassion from such beings. And there's obviously no compassion which is shown there. And remember, just the heart of all spirituality will be kindness, will be compassion. So where's the compassion there? Because I rejected that even as a youth, how can you say that that's a God punishing people? Look, there's kids who die in that earthquake. 4 or 5 year old children, they've done nothing bad at all. People of all different religions, all genders, all sexual orientations. Because natural disasters do not discriminate between the good and the bad, between one religion and another, between one sort of sexual orientation or another. Natural disasters, they sort of kill, maim, and hurt indiscriminately. So could a God be indiscriminate? Could karma be indiscriminate? And of course, karma cannot be indiscriminate like that. But even more than that, something which really offends me, and I'm saying this quite literally, you know, I do get offended sometimes by ideas which I feel are just so cruel, heartless, and basically wrong. One of the things which offends me is the idea of punishing. And the idea of like a God punishing people by squashing them in an earthquake, taking away their limbs, or even karma being a form of punishment, just really offended me from the very beginning. And as you know, that when I first came in contact with Buddhism, seeing there's no concept of punishment there, made, alas, there is a religion which truly is compassionate. So karma is not there to punish anybody. It's not as if that, you know, that I've kicked somebody in the, I punched somebody in the nose in my past life, which is why I have to have hay fever in this life. Now that's a totally ridiculous idea, but sometimes that's what people say is the law of karma, and that's totally off. And again, the very idea of punishment is just not the spiritual way. As I mentioned many, many, many times here, that, and I mentioned this in an answer to a question in Armadale last Tuesday night, that all that punishment really does to you is to make sure you don't get caught next time. And also just how many people deserve punishment. Sometimes I've looked at people who've done a bad thing, but that doesn't make them a bad person. As I said here last week, I've been to prisons, visiting many prisons in many lands, part of my job, and I've never seen a murderer, I've never seen a thief, I've never seen a rapist, and I've been in many, many jails. All I've ever seen is actually a person who's raped, a person who's stolen, but not a thief. And because whenever I see a person, yeah, they may have done a bad act, but they're not a bad person. So sometimes, how can you punish anybody? What are you actually punishing? You're punishing a person. You're not punishing that sort of bad thing they did. And anyway, how many stupid things have I done in my life? And I've mentioned many of them to you because, you know, I'm honest and I tell what I did when I was a kid and all the stuff which I did. I'm very happy to say that because one of these days, one of my friends, or say my brother, is going to come and visit Perth. He's going to tell me all the things I got up to when I was a young man. And you find I wasn't born a saint. Sometimes people have got these weird ideas of like monks as if, you know, I was born with a bald head. Well, actually, my mum said I was born with a bald head, but I wasn't sort of a monk when I was young. I got up to all sorts of mischief and did all sorts of weird things. And for example, I took my first glass of beer when I was 14 years of age, sneaking to a pub, even though it was totally illegal. But it's just what a boy had to do. So he did some really weird and strange things. And actually, one of my friends from university, from college, I hope he's destroyed this picture. He's got a picture of me sneaking into the college where I lived at night with my girlfriend, climbing over the wall. So yeah, okay, I was a young man, okay, did whatever. But does that make me a bad person? And of course, it's a person who does bad things. So how can you punish somebody? So when I see somebody, you know, maybe sort of a monk who's made a mistake, or maybe, you know, a person sort of here who's done a terrible thing, it's just so hard for me to get upset and angry enough to actually want to punish them. And you look at this person, they're just a really good person. All the people which I've met in my life, even in jails, they've all been these beautiful people. I've got this great faith in humanity. I've never yet met an evil person. And I met some amazing people. But, you know, really sort of, you know, criminals, gang leaders. But sometimes if you see, look for their beautiful part, you can see incredible beauty in even these people who have done terrible, terrible crimes. But they're really beautiful people. They're beautiful people who have sometimes done something wrong. But the majority of them, if you look at the whole of them, they're really good people. So how can you punish somebody? Does anyone deserve to be crushed to death in an earthquake? What crime, bad thing, would they have to do to experience that? Does anybody deserve to be swept away by a tsunami? Is that punishment really valid? And to me, the laws of this universe can never be like that. There can never be such cruelty, such vindictiveness. So karma is not vindictive. It's not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I was right the other day. Look, you know, there's enough blindness in this world already to have an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I like to see people smiling with their full teeth, not just a few teeth missing. So just an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth just increases the blindness and the lack of beautiful smiles in our world. And that's obviously that you can see that that's not just literal, that's also metaphorical as well. You know, that revenge just makes people more stupid, takes in its blindness, and it also takes away the compassion, the beautiful smiles you see. So it is not vindictive at all. So to understand what it is, there's a classic story, and if anyone is asked here about what did people do to suffer in the earthquake in Christchurch, this is the answer you can give them, and it's a deep answer. At first, these answers seem to be superficial, but if you start really reflecting upon them, using them, you can see there's actually something very profound here. Simple, truthful, but deep. And that was that story of that a disciple of Ajahn Chah who got drafted into the Thai army. And after a few weeks, you know, after training, a few weeks, he was in one of the border areas of Thailand. And he got shot at, he got badly wounded, put in hospital, invalided out of the army. And so he came to see my master Ajahn Chah saying, "What karma did I do to be wounded like this, to be shot and be so infirm?" You know what Ajahn Chah said? "The reason why you got shot was because you joined the army." It's the karma of joining the army, because that's what happens if you join the army. You're going to get shot. At least somebody's going to get shot. You shoot bullets at others, others will shoot bullets at you. Now, that might seem very obvious, but If you look at it, this is the nature of joining the arm, and he extended that. Why is it that some people sort of die in an earthquake or in a tsunami or in a car crash or in all these other ways which we may die? It is because you've joined the human race. It's the nature of being born, that we can die at any time from all these myriad of causes. And that's something which you can't argue with. Each one of you being born has this hanging over you. At any time, from a heart attack, and you know that was it last year, 2 years ago, someone died just right there of a heart attack when they asked the question after the talk. They've died in our monastery. You may have seen people dying. And it's been actually a privilege to be with people when they're dying, and especially to see that process of death. It really brings it home to you that this can happen to you at any time. And don't think just because you eat brown rice and do yoga and meditate, you can't have a heart attack as well. It happens to everybody. So what it really means is that because you've joined the human race, these things can happen to you. And what that really means when you really take that deep inside of you is that you don't say that something has gone wrong. It shouldn't happen. You say that this is our nature. It wasn't caused by karma, it wasn't caused by God. The earthquake was caused by natural reasons, by nature. It's just what happens. And we can't stop that, we can't predict that. But what we can do is to embrace that sort of truth, which means that it's a waste of time getting angry at other people, it's a waste of time in dwelling in the past, it's a waste of time worrying about the future and being afraid, oh, this might happen to me, this might happen to me, because the whole purpose, you know, is to make the best use of the time which you have here, knowing that it's not going to last. We have to make use of it. There's another story which comes in here, which is a powerful story as well. Simple, but useful in so many different circumstances. And that's the old story of the emperor's ring. The emperor who got really upset when things went wrong in his kingdoms. Whenever times things were going well, he would party. So he spent half the time depressed, and the other half of the time just partying, which meant he never did the job of being a king. So the ministers had to meet together. They couldn't tell the king what to do because he chopped their heads off. So he had to be smart. Instead, the ministers got a jeweler to make the king a ring. The only thing on the ring which stood out was the words engraved on the outside, "This too will pass," which he had to wear at all occasions. And it would be great. I know that at least one person here has actually made a ring with that engraving on it because they were inspired by the story. So they actually did it. And what it means is not just, oh, I've got cancer, oh, I'm depressed, oh, it's a hot day, soon we'll get cool again. Not just to use that saying for the bad times, which is what most people do. They understand that story, oh yeah, things are going bad, it will pass. But they don't use that story when things are going well in their life, when you're having a good time. We don't realize that the earthquake can come any time, even in Perth. We don't realize that the heart attack can come any time, even if you've got a healthy body, so you think. We don't realize this, you know, that, well, who knows what's coming next. When we realize this, it doesn't make us afraid, but it makes us alive. Alive especially to the fact of life is here to be made use of, and we waste so much of our life. How much of your life have you wasted today? Wasted worrying about things which would never happen. Wasted about dwelling upon the past which you can't change. Wasting upon being irritated by tiny stupid things which... What are you irritated about those things for? Just people call you a pig. So what? They can say whatever they like. I'm not going to get irritated by that. I'm not going to allow another person's stupidity to steal my life. And that's what they're doing. They're stealing your happiness, your peace. They're stealing your life. Why do you allow all these worries and concerns to take away what is really precious? And this too will pass. And understanding things like earthquakes, and understanding things like tsunamis, understanding even things like robberies in your house, understanding it, this too will pass, makes you more alive to this moment, valuing it more, and not just being so heedless. That was the Buddha's last words of advice, as many of you traditional Buddhists know. Sort of strive on with don't be heedful, don't be sort of heedless. And what they really mean there is because these disasters happened, it means that now we have life, let's make the best use of it. Let's really enjoy, put all our effort into it, find peace, find fulfillment, do it while we can, because this too will pass. What happened to that emperor? It meant he didn't just spend time partying. He really worked hard for the peace, happiness and health of his kingdom. And of course, those good times lasted much longer. So once you understand that this too will pass, it makes you a much happier, healthier, more productive person, because we don't waste time. How much time, again, do we waste? You just asked that question earlier and you probably know just too much. So the first thing which, you know, things like a Christchurch earthquake, fires, floods tell us, is don't waste time. It goes too quickly. And the other thing it tells us, and those of you who have ever been through a disaster, that when we look on it afar, we think this is a terrible tragedy. But when actually you're in close, that many of those tragedies, they've got some beautiful, beautiful things happen. I'm telling a story which I heard a long, long time ago. I haven't told for many years now, I think, although I'm getting old and I forget what I said last week, just like other people do. So this was a story, I think there was some major famine, probably in Africa, I can't remember exactly. And of course, one of the these people, they were a Buddhist, they went off to volunteer to help in a famine in Africa. And when they came back, they were talking with one of the monks, and they were actually saying, the monk was saying, that must have been terrible, because, you know, he'd seen the pictures of, you know, these starving people, men, women and children, with their bloated bellies and flies all over them, dying. And it must have been terrible there. And he said, well, it was just, you know, pretty really right there on the edge. And she said her job, what she was given by this, you know, this camp, I don't know, was run by UNESCO or run by something or Oxfam, I forget which. They had a camp, and they had to have barbed wire on the outside because they only had a certain amount of food and water and medicines, and it was nowhere near enough for everybody. And they knew if they spread it around thinly, they would help no one at all. So they realized the only thing they do, they had a number of people they could look after. And that was the number they could allow into the camp. And she said her job, this lady, this Buddhist from UK, I think she was, her job was every morning to go outside the barbed wire with a number given by the person in charge and allow that number of people in, knowing that those outside would probably die in the next 24 hours. And this monk, I remember saying, she told me the story, he said to this woman, said, it must have been a terrible thing. I mean, you were actually choosing, you know, who would live and who would die. You only had a certain number. How did you cope with that? And she said that was just one of the most inspiring experiences of my life. Because all those people who had arrived the night before, they didn't say, take me. They didn't, you know, rush at the entrance and try and barge their way through. They all said, take this other woman. She's just got a young child. Don't take me. And just that inspiring way that people, even though they face certain death, could be selfless and could be compassionate, just showed her what the human being is capable of. Not being afraid of death, because they found that compassion and kindness and selflessness was more important. She said to see that was one of the most inspiring things of her life. Even in a tragedy, she saw such beauty of spirit in the human beings that really uplifted her. And the punchline of that story, this is not a joke but a true story, was when the monk asked her, well, what are you doing now? She said, I'm back at work in the tax office. How's that? Now that really is depressing. She'd rather be at work out there choosing who would die and who would live than in the tax office, because there in that camp she saw such beauty, such compassion and kindness. But in the safe and comfortable tax office, all she saw were petty bickering and just the jealousies and all these other terrible things we see in a comfortable office. And from that story, and from many others, whenever you have been in a tragedy, whenever you've seen such beauty, it tells me that when there is a tragedy, it's not the tragedy which is tragic, but it's how people deal with it makes it tragic or makes it a blessing. And this is the reason why this story is going to go into intentions in a minute. It's not the tragedy, but how we deal with it. Because you can see in that first example of people working in a camp, feeding people during a famine, it was just the way people dealt with that life and death situation which made it even beautiful, which made it inspiring, uplifting, something she would never forget throughout her whole life, not with sadness, but with a sense of uplift. And even, I'm sure, in the tragedy in Christchurch, there are such beautiful moments of people helping each other, looking after each other, serving each other, being so selfless and kind. And that is what makes human beings beautiful. Life is not just about living and dying, about tragedies or avoiding tragedies. It's how we live that life, how we deal with the tragedies. It's how we do life, not life. And that is a general teaching of the law of karma, of the law of Buddhism. Because we cannot control life. We cannot control what happens to us. We cannot just try and move to places where there are no earthquakes. We can't just move to places where there are no tsunamis, where there's no fires. Wherever we are, we're always going to have some danger there. And that danger will eventually happen to someone. You know, to people in this room. You all know, as somebody reminded me of this, it was actually 20-year anniversary just on the 1st, actually the 31st of January, from that big crown fire which came through Bodhinyana Monastery, and I was there at that time, and trees explode in the fire, and it wasn't here for the Rolling Stone fire, it was in Hong Kong. But I know what those crown fires are like, and just the sound of them. And just trees explode, they are like bombs going off. And you're right in the middle of it. And what was amazing was just the way we cope with it. As monks, we didn't get upset, we weren't afraid, we just did what needed to be done. But I do remember afterwards, a couple of weeks afterwards, we got these students from Murdoch University, one of our local universities, because they knew we were in this sort of life-threatening situation. And they gave me sort of a questionnaire because they were doing a research on the psychology of survivors of trauma. And they asked all these questions, said, do you have recurrent dreams of fires, and are you afraid? And I said, no, 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 no. And I really messed up their research. Because you're supposed to have some trauma, you're supposed to be upset at these things. Say, no, look, as a Buddhist monk, we just let these things go. We don't worry about things. So what if you die? You know, you get reborn again. That's maybe one of the reasons why Buddhists don't get upset about such things. You know, we have another chance. Amazing, if you only had one chance at life, then that would be a bit scary. And that's one of the other reasons. In these tragedies, yes, there are tragedies, and we've been through these tragedies before in previous lives. And a Buddhist actually understands this reincarnation. I know there are some people here, yeah, question, wonderful question. You don't have to believe these things, but please do the research. Get on the internet. So easy to do research these days. There's so much evidence out there, I mean, really strong, hard evidence of reincarnation that, you know, it's just compelling. I mean, there was somebody sent this email to us from this professor of Georgia State University, Robert Almeida, his name was, Almeder, who is a professor of philosophy. And he had actually come across Ian Stevenson's work, and he went on this video segment saying, look, as a professor of philosophy, you know, having trained my mind, you know, in philosophical truths, there's only one conclusion that any rational person can come to once they read that work, and that reincarnation is true. The evidence is compelling. It's just too strong. There's no other reasonable explanation for all that evidence which this, you know, man, Professor Ian Stevenson, he was from Virginia University, has compiled over a long period of time. I don't know why people resist it, because if you are going to be rational, if you are going to be scientific, the evidence is there. So at least look at it first of all, you know, before you make your decisions. And what that really means is when there is a tragedy, a lot of time the Buddhists don't get so upset like other people would if it's only just going to be one life. You can have another go at it, so don't be so upset. So even seeing it in that perspective, it takes away a lot of the pain of the tragedies. And I think one of the reasons why people overreact to tragedies is there's such a fear of death because of the wrong assumption this is the only chance we have. It is a fear of death which really upsets just the way people act in this world. I mentioned that to a group of medical students over in, it was in Johor Bahru, because Monash University has a campus over in Johor Bahru, and as many medical students came to my talk. And I told them that old thing, that your job is not to cure people as a medical student, as a doctor in the future. Don't go around curing people. Go around caring for people. It's a whole different ball game. You cure people because you're afraid of death. You're caring for people because you love life and appreciate life. And just seeing that just changes people's whole attitudes. We don't have these terrible interventions at all costs to save life, because we care for the person. Caring is more important than curing. And just simple things like that come when we don't have this great fear of dying, as if that's the worst possible thing we can do. Compassion is more important. So even a tragedy, is a tragedy the most important, or the lack of compassion, or the presence of compassion in such tragedies? It's the presence of compassion in such tragedies which is important. It's not life, but how we live that life. It's not these events which happen, but how we react to them. And that is what we should be doing in life. We can't control life. These things happen. Mistakes happen. People do the wrong things. They cheat us. They're cruel to us. Diseases happen. It's not the cancer, it's how you deal with the cancer. It's not the death, it's how you deal with that loss. It's not just the earthquake or the tsunami, it's just how you deal with that. And the wonderful thing about Buddhism is that is what karma means, what you do with what you've got. And that is the right intention, whether you're at work, whether you're at home, in the hospital, in the prison, working to get survivors out. It's how you're doing that. What is your intention? And the quality of the intention is the kindness, the generosity, the selflessness, the compassion. That is the most important part. That interface between you and what you have to deal with, that is where spirituality, Buddhism, lives. It doesn't live within the person. It's nothing to do with what's out there. It's the interface, the relationship between you and that tragedy. And that means there is always something to do, always something you can do. One of the biggest problems with a tragedy like an earthquake, that people feel helpless. They feel afraid, there's nothing we can do, these things are going to happen, I can't control it, because the forces of nature are beyond control, and that's why people get so afraid when these things happen. I remember reading about the town of Lockerbie in Scotland after that aircraft went down, fell from the sky. The survivors couldn't sleep at night afterwards. They survived, but it was a crazy idea that now that an aircraft had come down on top of their village, they thought another aircraft could come down at any time. It was fear which was crippling them. And the fear was that they could not control, you know, their security and safety. And it's the same with, you know, sometimes that you hear the neighbor next door got robbed and you feel so afraid that you've got no security anymore. It's not whether you're robbed, it's actually how you deal with that. Look, there's this one person over in Perth, they were working up in the mines. And so their wife was left at home alone. And so he thought that all the security systems in the world can't stop these thieves, so decided to get a dog. So went to the pet shop to get a watchdog. You know, her joke is coming now. Went to the pet shop to get a watchdog. And the pet shop owner sort of came out with this little Pekingese. And the guy said, I can't use a Pekingese dog. You know, what sort of burglar would be afraid of such a tiny dog? And he said, now listen, this is not an ordinary Pekingese dog. This was raised in a Buddhist monastery in China. And he was taught karate. This dog is a black belt in karate. Look, I'll show you, said the owner. And he told it that he told the dog, karate my box over there. And in about 5 seconds, that box would reduce to shreds. And he said, karate my chair. And that dog made that chair into matchsticks. And that was one tough dog. So just because they're small doesn't mean they're not dangerous. So he said, I'll take that dog. And so he brought the dog home and he told his wife, said, wife, this is your watchdog. When I'm up north, this dog will protect you. He said, no, don't be ridiculous. It's too small to protect me. And the man said, that dog knows karate. And the wife said, karate my foot. The moral of that story, always believe your husband. So, okay, so you get your house robbed. How do you relate to that? How do you do that? I remember this one woman came up to me, and it's a Thai lady, that somebody came into her house and said, what did he steal? He stole all my whiskey. I said, good thing, you shouldn't have any in there to begin with. You're supposed to be a Buddhist. So I said, that was a very good burglar. I'm going to give him the address of a few other people who should burgle. But what does that actually do when you actually have a tragedy like that? Again, you can get negative about it and get afraid about it. You can sort of start crying about it. You start to get angry about it, which is what many people do when they have a tragedy. You know, that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, when she did her death and dying, the four stages of grief. And anger was, you know, denial was one of them. Anger is another of them. That is not the Buddhist way. The Buddhist way is not denial, accepting. Yeah, this happened. It can happen anywhere, anytime. It's acceptance, honesty. If you join the human race, you can die of an earthquake. If you don't believe me, next time you get reborn, read the contract before you actually get reborn. It's in there. You can die at any time of anything. So be honest. Number two, don't get angry and think that something has gone wrong. Instead, actually, we make use of this. So if there is a great tragedy, if any one of you has lost a friend, a loved one, in an earthquake in New Zealand, or lost someone from somewhere else, what does it teach you? Their life, and especially their death, what's its meaning for you? There is a meaning there. There's a message which is supposed to be telling you, but when you cry, when you get angry, you're not listening. Well, that message is that all of us can die at any time. As the Buddha said, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. Actually, when I was a young monk, I used to chant that almost every day. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. So as a result, what do we do? You know, we don't get depressed. The opposite happens. Because you know that all the loved ones which you know and care for are one day going to leave you. When they're in front of you, you really care for them. You appreciate their presence. That one day becomes so much more valuable. You don't waste so much time. There's things to be done. You do them today. Because our loved ones, they may not always be here. You know it's truth, it's being honest. These are simple truths, but sometimes we're in denial. We live our life as if in denial, as if we're going to live forever, as if our loved ones are going to be around forever, and that is the problem. We forget the ring, this too will pass. And when it does have a tragedy, that's why people get so upset. I mean, Christchurch, it's on a fault. Should have known from the first place this could happen any time. Just because it happened once a few months ago doesn't mean it won't happen again. Where I live, up in Serpentine, it's a bushfire zone. I know it's going to happen again. I know there's going to be a bushfire up there. It's just a matter of time. That's why we're so well prepared at our monastery. So we're just waiting for it to happen. It's not being in denial, which is what happens to many people in bushfire zones. It's not in people with bodies. Sometimes we're in denial. Oh no, we're not really going to be sick. That little lump in my body, oh, that's not a cancer. I don't get cancer. No, it won't be a cancer. Which means you don't go and check it out while there's time to cure it. So please do not be in denial to the nature of life. So what it's teaching us is to be honest, truthful, that it can happen any time, and because it can happen any time, because we know that all that's mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me, that's why we care. That's why we're compassionate. I don't know if I told this one recently. When was the last time I did a simile of the crack in the cup? Was that a couple of weeks ago? A couple of months? Okay, that's long enough so I can repeat it again. My teacher, Ajahn Chah, would say something similar. Do you see this glass here? It's got a crack in it. Just like in Christchurch, there's a crack in the ground, the fault lines. Do you see the crack in the cup, he would say. And I say, no, you must be, I can't see. I'm blind or you're blind. And he said, the crack is microscopic. That's why you can't see it. But there's a crack there, he said. Because one day, someone like you is going to drop my cup and the crack is going to open up and therefore it's going to be unusable. It's going to die. But he said, because it's got a crack in it, that's why you should care for it and look after it and don't treat it heedlessly. But he said, if this cup was made out of plastic, you could drop it, you can throw it around, you can stamp on it, it's unbreakable. If it was unbreakable, you would not need to care. Because it's fragile, he said, that's why you should be compassionate. Because all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from us. Because all your friends and loved ones will one day part from you. That's why you should be kind and compassionate and mindful. If they were going to be here forever, you can always be compassionate tomorrow, next year, but not now. That's a very beautiful teaching on the message and the meaning of earthquakes and tsunamis. It's a crack. It's reminding us the fragility of our life, the fragility of our bodies, which means we care and we are kind. We're compassionate. What does caring and kindness, compassion mean? It doesn't just mean sitting here and thinking, oh, I'm going to be kind. It's actually doing something. And actually acting compassionately, speaking kindly. And that's one of the, I read this a few days ago, that somebody complained about Buddhism. Yeah, we're very good about thinking compassion and teaching compassion, but we're not that good at doing compassion. And like, what's the point of thinking about it and teaching if we don't actually do something or speak kindly to forgive each other, to forgive others who have hurt us? Not just to think it, but actually to say it, to actually to help someone, to care for them, spend time with them, give them a lift if they need somewhere to go. And there's so many opportunities to be compassionate. And we miss them. And if we're missing those opportunities, we're missing life. We're missing just the teaching of the cup with the microscopic crack in it. And it's events like earthquakes. It's events like a close friend of ours gets cancer and dies. It's events like that which remind us that we can't be compassionate tomorrow. We have to be compassionate today to actually to do it. To see how we can actually serve. Yeah, you've got your own things to do, but look, all those duties which you have to do, even this weekend, what do you get out of those? How much does it help others? At the end of your life, if you were gonna die on Monday morning. Many of you may think that might be a good idea, then I don't have to go to work. That's actually another joke which I read today about if you've got a stupid boss, don't complain about having a stupid boss. If he wasn't stupid, he would probably fire you. It's a bit cynical, but sometimes that's very true. But if you were going to die on Monday, how would you live today? And that was actually one of the other reflections which, you know, religious people are supposed to be doing. To live as if this was your last day on earth, how would you live? And strategies like the, you know, for many people, just, was it Tuesday it happened, wasn't it? The Christchurch earthquake, was it Tuesday? Yeah, for many, that sort of that Monday was their last day on earth, for many, many people. Wonder how well they lived that day. It makes you think, how well do I want to live this day? Because it might be my last as well. And if you can do that, living every day as if it was your last, remembering that crack in the cup, I've got to really care and be compassionate. How do you live that life? Not with fear. Because fear doesn't help anything. Fear is not the right way to relate to disasters. It's a sense of urgency. The urgency to be kind. The urgency to be compassionate. The urgency to forgive. The urgency to love. Not tomorrow, but today. And that is the message, the teaching. So when we get angry, when we sort of in denial, when we're even afraid, we don't listen to those teachings. And those teachings really help our lives. There are many, many people who were in a tragedy and it totally transformed their lives for the better. They just became such amazing human beings. Because it really taught them what life is all about. Sometimes we don't find the meaning of life by watching Oprah Winfrey. We don't find the meaning of life, you know, even from listening to talks like this. Sometimes you find the meaning of life in those difficult times, almost unbearable times, when some kind, compassionate person just helps you. And you realize, wow. That is so beautiful. That is so wonderful. That is what life is all about. One of the stories which comes up again. The first monastery our tradition opened up was in England. And it wasn't really a monastery. It was a house in a suburb of Hampstead in London. And it was a very miserable place to live in London, especially during the winter time. Don't complain about the heat in Australia. At least you've got sunny skies. You know, in UK in the winter time, I remember because I lived there, I grew up there, and I went to school in the morning, maybe about 8:30, 9 o'clock. It was dark, no, black dark, and you went home after about 3:30, and it was dark again. You know, the sun would only come up maybe about 10 o'clock in the morning, and about 2 p.m. it set again. This was, you know, winter time in quite north country like England. And when it was, the sky was bright. It was never really bright like the beautiful bright skies in Australia. It was like dull. And this is why it was, everything was grey. You know, you've heard this story before, but it's actually quite true. All the people in winter time, they don't wear bright clothes. It's all grey overcoats and grey hats. You know, seeing these people with their umbrellas, all black umbrellas. I've never seen anyone with an umbrella with like polka dots or red and green and yellow, like, you know, you see over here. It's always dark clothing. And even the, you know, all the buildings, those of you who've been to London, it's this grey, dirty stone. That was all that was there. And, you know, there was nothing there except all the streets were grey, the skies were grey, the buildings were grey, and all the people were grey. And you know what tea they liked the best? Oh, grey. Everything was grey. No wonder people sort of get sort of depressed when it's, you know, at that sort of time of the year. So this monk, you know, he's used to the forests of Thailand, you know, bright and sort of brilliant. And he was bored out of his mind looking through the window in the morning. And it was, you know, it doesn't even rain properly, you know, over in England. It drizzles. You know, it's not even real rain. It's like a half rain, like a pathetic rain. So it was drizzling outside, you know, another grey morning in London. And what he actually saw, there was this destitute man was huddled in the archway of a building. Now, just to get out of the rain, he'd obviously been there all night. There's a bottle next to him. Now, that bottle, the homeless people in those days, they would actually be drinking a bottle of what they call methylated spirits, because they could not afford whiskey, and that would just keep them warm. It's incredibly bad for your health, and it made you stink. And I remember, to this day, I remember the stink of people who used to drink methylated spirits, because I came across them every now and again growing up in London. And there's this guy, just homeless, dirty, stinky, just huddled in a corner, away from the cold and the rain. And then he saw one of these English men coming, going to work. And they don't do it these days. This was many years ago. Just, you know, with a bowler hat and this sort of... I don't know if any of you ever remember that movie. Oh, no, the TV series called The Avengers. And this is when I was a kid. John Steed, you know, was always dapperly dressed, a nice suit, nice bowler, a nice hat, furled umbrella. Just, you know, people when they're going to work in England in those days used to really dress up. So this guy, dressed up, ready for work, was walking down the street. And as the monk was looking out the window, this office worker, impeccably dressed, leant over to this homeless guy, said a few words which obviously he couldn't hear, and very gently put his arm around this homeless guy, picked him up, and took him for something to eat. And he said that stink of that man's body would be on that beautiful suit. The guy would be late for work and maybe get shouted at by his boss. But it didn't matter. He had the opportunity to help someone who was hungry and alone. And he took that opportunity. It was a simple act of compassion to someone who's tragically destitute. And how beautiful that was. He said that took away all the greyness of London. Because it wasn't the skies or the buildings or the drizzle. It was just the people and what they did in that situation. I'm sure that when people look at all of the ruin, collapsed infrastructure in Christchurch, it will look so grey and hopeless. But don't look at the ruins. Look at the beautiful people who are helping and serving without sleep, being kind, selfless, compassionate. And that's what makes life shine and become brilliant, takes away the greyness. Simple acts of kindness and compassion. That's what these tragedies are here for, to bring out the very best in human beings. It's a shame that we need a tragedy to have that happen. But how many people visit you and say how much you mean to them in normal life, but you become sick, you get diagnosed with cancer, and then all the people come out and tell you how much you mean to them. Why does it need a tragedy for that to happen? Unfortunately, that's our nature. So tragedies are there to bring the best out in people. They will always happen, it's part of life. But it's how we deal with it. That is what the spiritual life is all about. So even in tragedies, and of course to bring up to the other question about how do you use intention when you go to work, sometimes going to work is a tragedy, but maybe of a different type. And when you do have to go to work, it's not the work, it's how you relate to the work, what you give to it. And you know that even in the most meager occupation, even if you're washing floors, even if you're scrubbing toilets, this is how I was taught when I used to scrub toilets in monasteries, and sometimes you still scrub toilets today, even I'm a senior famous monk. It's how you scrub those toilets. It's not the fact you have to scrub them. Put care and love into what you're doing. It's not just that you have to talk to a person. It's how you talk to them. Put some compassion into the people you meet at work. It's not that you have to drive to work in the traffic, which is sometimes so busy and so many people trying to get into your lane. Let them get into your lane. Be compassionate. It's not the traffic jam. It's how you relate to the traffic jam. The amount of peace and compassion you put into these things. That should be your intention in life. Whether you're going to work or you're helping in an earthquake or you're helping restore the broken lives and homes in Roadstone Armada. It's how you do those things. That makes the beauty in life. And I know, having lived through those big bushfires, the Crown Fire, you know, it was 46.4 degrees in Perth the day the fire came to our monastery. It was that day was the hottest day ever recorded. It was another hotter day a month or two later, but still the day the fire came through Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, still to this day is the second hottest day ever recorded in Perth. As we got this huge fire at the same time. But you look at our monastery now, you would never believe there was a fire there. Life has grown up again. From ashes come regeneration. I know from my history books, in my town I was born in London, they had a huge fire, had Black Death and then the fire of 1666, if I remember correctly. The fire of London. It was because of the plague which happened beforehand that the city of London redesigned the sewer system to give a state-of-the-art system to clean the whole place up. And because of the Great Fire, they could plan much better buildings and a much more modern city. From tragedies, like a phoenix, a more beautiful life appears. There is such a thing as reincarnation of cities, reincarnation of homes, reincarnations of communities. And sometimes you do need that regeneration. You do need the fire in the bush to make it strong again. It's part of the nature of the Australian bush. You do need the tragedies to teach us the meaning of life. And then when we go to work, it's the intentions, the way we deal with things. That is where we do have the power. We will never be able to stop or predict earthquakes. We'll never be able to stop and predict tsunamis. We'll never be able to stop and predict cancers. We can try our very best, but we will not succeed. But what we can do, where we do have full power, is how we relate to these events when they occur to us and others. It's not the cancer, it's what we make of it. It's not the earthquake, but how it generates the very best in human beings and reminds us to keep on generating those wonderful qualities of compassion, generosity and selflessness. Not thinking of our own needs, but thinking of the person in the house next door, or rather the person who hasn't got the house next door anymore. That is the meaning of life. That is what karma really means. Not as a punishment, but as getting us involved. Karma literally does mean work. It means doing things. It means actions. That's its meaning in Pali and Sanskrit. It's how we act. The events of life, they give us the ingredients. What we make of those ingredients is called karma. And that's where we have full freedom to make something beautiful, to rise to these tragedies. And just like that story of that homeless man in London, to have beauty come in the most unexpected places, in the grey, cold drizzle of a London morning, to see beauty in tragedy. That is what we can do. And that's the talk for this evening. So, has any comments or questions about that? Yes. The what, sorry? Victory chant. Yeah. Oh, that's didn't mention in this talk. That's the Jayamangala, or the, in short, it's the Mahakarunikonato Hitaya Sapapani Nang. Jayanto Bodhi Ambule. It's the story of the Buddha's victory under the Bodhi tree. If you come to me later on, I can go get one of the books from the library and show it to you. It, like many of these things, they've got other names as well. And so that's just one of its epithets, the victory chant. I thought you actually meant the victory chant in Australia is, was it Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi? That's only when they're in the cricket. Any other comments or questions? So please, whatever happens to you in life, never really get depressed. Don't get angry. Don't get afraid. There's opportunities there to do something much more high than that. Okay, so now we can have our announcements.
Thank you, Ajahn, for that wonderful talk filled with so much compassion. Thank you for the new joke about the karate dog. I have a few announcements. There's a sutta class conducted by Ajahn Brahm on Sunday.
It's going to be Sutta 69.
Sutta 69.
69, Gudisari Sutta, the forest monk.
Thank you. Beginner's meditation class starts next four Saturdays from the 5th of March, 3 to 4:15. We also have the seminary ordination of the Anagarikas, Upeka and Sally, on Sunday, the 6th of March, 1 o'clock at Dhammaloka Hall. A lot of people are confusing Dhammaloka with Dhammasara.
Oh, yeah.
So please.
This is a nun's ordination, how we make nuns.
So the nuns' monastery in Gijiganap will be closed for that day because all the nuns will be down here. And talking about nuns, there is a lovely young lady, Joanne, who is going to shave off her hair, her beautiful long hair, to raise funds.
We'll
Joanne, can you stand up, please?
Yes, stand up to your hair. An old saying about hair, hair
oh,
today.
You should let your hair down.
Hair today, gone tomorrow.
She's raising funds for the new sala for Dhammasara Monastery. You can either see her or there are details on the board. The Dharma in Daily Life Retreat from the 25th to the 27th of March. Registration is still going on. Please, can you see Anusha? Anusha, are you here?
Yes, she's there.
Anusha, there is a lady.
Anusha? Yeah, so see, yeah.
There is a lady who has a form for you. So, I think it was Margot. Margot, that's Anusha, if you can see her afterwards. Registrations are still being taken, so if you're interested, please see Anusha. Now, on the 21st of March, Sunday, there is the Miniwara Festival. Our Armadale group will have an information stall representing BSWA in this annual Miniwara Festival in Armadale. Details are on the board. So, thank you.
Very good. So, I hope you enjoyed the talk tonight. Now we can pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha if you wish, totally voluntary. So we use your bow and just say a very short chant.
Arahant Sama Sambuddha Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami